Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with information from Mike Rupert's From the Wilderness newsletter. Now, in a pair of half-hour segments recorded in early September of 1998, I reviewed some information concerning allegations of the involvement of a former Special Forces operative named Bill Tyree in a CIA drug trafficking operation called Operation Watchtower, in which he and other Special Forces operatives infiltrated Colombia and placed special electronic beacons to guide CIA drug planes into Panama for transshipment of the drugs into the United States. In addition to those allegations, we also reviewed allegations concerning the participation of a man named Albert Vincent Caron, a man who wore hats, allegedly wore hats. Well, he certainly wore the hat of a New York Police Department detective, and also allegedly wore the hats of a military officer, a CIA officer, and numerous other things as well, and organized crime. The allegations concerning Bill Tyree and his alleged connections to Albert Vincent Caron, among other things, are the focus of a massive lawsuit that has been filed, naming, among others, the Central Intelligence Agency and George Bush as defendants. We're going to return to that particular article about that particular lawsuit when the lawsuit was filed on Friday, September 4th. The lawsuit, I should say, was filed on September 4th of 1998. And a couple of days later, on the evening of September 6th, it was my privilege to interview Mike Rupert about that particular lawsuit. In the September 19th, 1998 issue of From the Wilderness, there's a long article about that lawsuit. It's headlined, "Speaking of headshots, $63 million federal lawsuit filed against George Bush, CIA, Chip Tatum, and Massachusetts officials by former Green Beret Bill Tyree. Suit links Albert Caron to missing diaries and cover-up by state officials and U.S. government." It then names the defendants: United States District Court, District of Massachusetts, William M. Tyree, plaintiff. The number is 98-C-Y-11829-JLT. And the defendants are Central Intelligence Agency, L. Scott Harshbarger, A. Paul Cellucci, George Bush, Dois Jean Tatum, defendants. And we're going to go directly to the next segment of the article. Our section of the article is called Caron, Putting the Pieces Together. I've read the previous sections of the article in a previous half-hour segment, along with a review of the allegations from the Wilderness concerning Bill Tyree and Albert Vincent Caron. Let me repeat yet again that neither myself nor the stations that broadcast this program have any information incriminating any of the people named in these articles in any sort of illegal activities, nor, to the best of my knowledge, has any of them been convicted of any crimes. That pro forma statement having been repeated, let's proceed with this article, a vitally important article by Mike Rupert in his From the Wilderness. This is about the lawsuit which is currently in the court system as I speak on September 27th of 1998 for the benefit of people who eventually hear this program on tape. The next section of the article is entitled Caron, Putting the Pieces Together, and this concerns some of the many allegations concerning Albert Vincent Caron and his many, many connections, including a connection to Bill Tyree, although Tyree's family, as we're about to read, had never heard the name Bill Tyree but knew of him as, quote, Sandy, unquote. This is called Caron, Putting the Pieces Together, this section of the article. It reads, "It was not until late 1996, in a series of events which involved this writer, that Bill Tyree learned that it had been Albert Caron who had received the diaries from Massachusetts and who had held them in his personal possession until November 1989, shortly before his own death. Albert Vincent Caron, by the way, that's C-A-R-O-N-E, a retired New York Police Department detective first grade, had served his entire life also as an officer in the U.S. Army Reserves assigned to military intelligence and the Counterintelligence Corps. He retired from NYPD in 1980 and moved to New Mexico, where he began work on Contra support operations. The Army served as the cover for his work, directed by the Central Intelligence Agency. Caron's connections both to organized crime and the CIA are extremely well documented and are a significant part of a large affidavit submitted by this writer in the suit. Among the records available are a personal phone book in which are listed the home addresses and phone numbers of both William Casey and Gambino family crime boss Paulie Castellano. There are also a host of other records tying Caron to a multitude of CIA operations, including laundering of Contra-era cocaine profits and such entities as the Nugan Hand Bank. Caron family members have produced a series of affidavits and records specifically referencing George Bush, Oliver North, Richard Secord, Elliot Abrams, Bill Casey, and many other CIA figures. Bill Casey attended the christening of Carone's grandson in the 1970s, and Santos Traficante and other mafia figures have been known to the family for decades as, quote, uncle, unquote. A complete report of my investigation of Albert Carone is available through From the Wilderness, and there's an ad for that on the back page. By the way, I would stress that the history of the intelligence community's involvement with drugs is detailed and at considerable length in RFA programs 24 through 28. And RFA 25 goes into the remarkable story of the Nugenhan Bank, a CIA and naval intelligence operation that, among other things, laundered narcotics profits. By the way, that again discussed in RFA 25. The Nugenhan Bank is one of the entities alluded to in this article. Continuing. In 1990, after he had expressed reservations at having participated in CIA operations resulting in the 1985 death of DEA agent Kiki Camarena, Carone died as a result of, quote, chemical toxicity of unknown etiology, unquote. Every conceivable record concerning Carone, including active bank accounts, life insurance policies, military records, NYPD files, and even his driver's license, disappeared. His daughter, D. Carone Ferdinand, and her family were left destitute. Although she didn't know it, Dee had known of Bill Tyree for a long time, only by a different name, Sandy. For many years, Carone had repeatedly referred to a great wrong done to Sandy in conversations with both Dee and her husband Tommy. Quote, Sandy was, said Dee, almost an obsession with Dad, unquote. Carone had participated not only in the Watchtower missions, but also in several other covert operations in which Tyree had also served under CIA direction. They knew each other well. Carone's role was that of, quote, paymaster, unquote, and bagman. The connections came slowly. In 1991, Tyree made contact with retired Army CID investigator William McCoy, who began investigating events connected with Tyree's case. McCoy was a well-respected Washington-area private investigator who had assisted in investigations with the Christic Institute in the 1980s. Though Tyree knew Carone from the Watchtower missions and other operations, his name was not initially given to McCoy. It was not until approximately 1994 that the Ferdinands and Tyree learned of each other's existence, and it was not until September of 1996 that Tyree and D. Ferdinand first made personal contact. It was a short time after that that D. Ferdinand realized that Tyree was the, quote, Sandy, unquote, referred to by her father, and it was not until 1997 that it became clear that Albert Carone had held Eileen Tyree's diary in his possession for many years. In affidavits filed in the lawsuit, the Ferdinands revealed that not only had they seen the diaries, but that both had actually held them and could describe contents thereof, which had never been published or otherwise described. Sometime in late 1989, knowing he was dying, Carone delivered the diaries to unnamed CIA officials. Note, the practice of law enforcement and military investigators knowingly holding key items of evidence in their personal possession is well known to this writer as a means of personal insurance, unquote. Such practice was well documented in a police spy scandal in Los Angeles in the 1980s. Carone's relations with George Bush are well documented in various investigations, including my own, and as well, through statements made by Carone to both Tyree and his own family. It is those statements and other records which will be produced at trial which provide the foundation showing that George Bush, as director of CIA during the Watchtower missions and as an active CIA executive in the years after, directly ordered Carone to Massachusetts in the wake of Elaine Tyree's murder to retrieve the diaries. This writer was first put in contact with D. Ferdinand in late 1993, by former CIA case officer David McMichael. After initial phone conversations, I traveled to New Mexico and produced an extensive report on Albert Carone, which I published and copyrighted in March. I sent a copy to retired CID investigator McCoy, who had spoken briefly to Dee previously, as well as to several other former Army and CIA employees. McCoy had been working with Tyree at that time for several years, but had not delved deeply into Carone's case. It was not until late 1994 that McCoy, after reading my investigation, began talking regularly to Ferdinand, and it was not until late 1996 that McCoy mentioned Ferdinand's maiden name, Carone, to Tyree. Tyree went through the roof. Bill McCoy passed away suddenly in 1997, and Tyree and Ferdinand began communicating directly. It was through those communications that Dee Ferdinand realized that Bill Tyree was the Sandy, unquote, so often referred to by her father, and that her father had actually held the diaries instead of destroying them. Preliminary work on the suit was commenced shortly thereafter. Dee Ferdinand had previously heard of Tyree through both Bill McCoy and me. None of us voiced any connection between the two cases, although it is possible that McCoy suspected one. I had received a document describing Tyree's case, known as the Cutolo Affidavit, in 1992, and this remained the sole piece of material I had on Tyree until I began receiving additional materials from McCoy in 1994. In none of those documents was the name Sandy ever mentioned. My first direct contact with Tyree came in 1996. Additional revelations in affidavits filed by Dee Ferdinand and her husband, as well as by other Carone family members, indicate that Albert Carone had also told his family that he had delivered cash payoffs to Jack Ruby in Dallas on November 21, 1963, and that he had been on a rooftop at Dallas's Love Field with a rifle as part of a CIA attempt to kill John Kennedy before the fateful motorcade got underway. A source close to the case has indicated that additional corroborative evidence as to the relationship between Carone and Ruby may be forthcoming. The suit is seeking $21 million in extrinsic damages, $1 million for each year of incarceration, $42 million in exemplary damages, $21 for the value of the diaries and the photographs, an injunction against the CIA from engaging in further illegal activities, and such legal remedies as are appropriate under the Constitution. That last part would, of course, include a new trial, and thus Tyree's freedom. So a lawsuit that touches many, many bases, including a subject that was the incident, that was the event that actually focused me in the direction of research that my life has taken, the assassination of President Kennedy. I've never heard of a possible attempt to kill Kennedy before the motorcade got underway. However, there is an account by a fellow named Albert Castillo, who maintains that he was part of a backup team that was prepared to kill President Kennedy in case he got through Dealey Plaza. Richard Case Nagel, the veteran U.S. intelligence operative who was the focal point of Dick Russell's landmark book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, arguably the best and certainly the most comprehensive book about the Kennedy assassination, refers to a number of different plots against Kennedy that were underway in the early 1960s. So this may have been one of those. Also, in case it's possible that had the plot been leaked, Carone may have been part of a fire team that was to dispatch Kennedy in the event that it was believed that he was alerted to the Dealey Plaza gambit. Any major assassination like this will certainly have backup contingencies set up. I would also note that I think it's unlikely that the CIA per se actually was the executive function in the assassination of President Kennedy. I doubt very seriously that the orders came from Langley, but there certainly appear to have been major elements of the CIA involved, albeit ones who viewed the CIA as distinctly pink and were marching to a drummer well to the right of the CIA. But there certainly were major elements of the CIA involved. Those addenda having been stated, we're going to visit next with Mike Rupert, one of the people involved in providing information on the suit, and we're going to hear more about this landmark lawsuit that is currently winding its way through the American legal system. And it's my pleasure once again to present Mike Rupert, the editor of From the Wilderness and a direct participant in this particular lawsuit. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Well, my guess is that this has been a taxing and adrenal experience for you. By the way, the audience has just heard the article about Bill Tyree from the April 25th issue of From the Wilderness, the article about Albert Vincent Carone from the June 21st issue, and has just heard in its entirety the article about this lawsuit in the 9/19/98 issue. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Mike, concerns the many, many issues that this suit touches on. Obviously, in the context of the texts of the articles that I've read, the connections to contra drug trafficking have certainly emerged. Now, one of the cases of contra-related drug trafficking, and one that's received a fair amount of publicity since Bill Clinton emerged on the national stage, has been the MENA Arkansas connection. What are you in a position to tell us, bearing in mind the security needs that undoubtedly obtain in this consideration, about that?
Well, there are, let me preface this by saying there are a great many people with a lot more information on MENA than I have. They've been at it a lot longer and they were in the region. However, In the current lawsuit, that is the suit from Tyree against George Bush and CIA, Albert Vincent Caron spent a considerable amount of time passing through Mena, Arkansas, and he was, I call him Oliver North's chief bagman. He was actually probably more like George Bush's chief bagman. He moved through the Mena region frequently, and there were strong connections. And these are detailed to some small degree in the original filing in the suit, between the cocaine, the CIA cocaine that was flowing through Mena, Arkansas, and some key people who were instrumental in Bill Clinton's early career, specifically Jackson Stevens, and some other people who were local to Arkansas.
And Jackson Stevens, a Republican, too, by the way.
Very close friend of George Bush. Yeah.
Yep. So the Mena connection certainly has received a certain amount of scrutiny, so this will touch on the Mena issue. A couple of the other major issues that are alluded to in the paragraph of your article, which talks about the many things that this suit is going to touch upon, it refers to a connection to political fundraising. Develop that for us, if you would.
Well, a lot of the money that went through, now this is history first, through Arkansas, and some investigators, Bill McCoy, who was mentioned in the article, and others working close to Mena, peg the figure close to $40 million a month in cocaine money that was being moved through the region. A lot of that money went through Arkansas Development Financial Authority and other savings and loan institutions and other financial apparatuses, which, of course, made Arkansas pretty healthy. Well, that attracted other attention from other sources that are going to be discussed in other avenues of the suit, but also in other stories like the Lippo Group, major overseas sources. Mena, for a long time, was really the center of the universe for cocaine money, although Bill Clinton was not the center of the universe himself.
Mm-hmm.
He was the king of the state, but he was not the king of the country, so to speak.
And as the Terry Reid and Cummings book said, compromised as a result.
Right, absolutely.
Continue.
Compromised, owned. I think Bill Clinton sold his soul a long time ago to get where he is.
As an aside, I once referred to George Bush as the first five-term president of the United States. Two of Reagan's, one of his own, and two of Clinton's.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was just yesterday speaking with Bill Davis, formerly of the Christic Institute, and Gary Webb, who wrote Dark Alliance series for the San Jose Mercury News. And Bill Davis made a very good point that Bill Clinton really was the fulfillment of the Reagan legacy, the Reagan promise. By virtue of his very conservative actions on welfare reform and crime and so forth.
I would agree with that, one exception, and we don't want to linger on this, being his judicial appointments, which have been blocked by the Republicans. He's been appointing centrist judges as opposed to people like Robert Bork, who in his latest book advocates eliminating the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
More about some of the many issues touched on by this lawsuit. You mentioned one of the subjects that the filings relate to is FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Yes, a lot of the work that was done on this was done by Bill McCoy, who is no longer with us. Bill Tyree's done some of the research. I've done a little bit of the research on that, but there's a lot of material floating around out there about FEMA that basically had its genesis back in the late 70s. And Bill Tyree had developed information on his own. This was not my research, showing that a lot of the early funding for FEMA was done out of the drug monies that were being accumulated in large quantities. And that's when you had Oliver North back in the late 70s working on the continuity of government issues, drafting legislation. I think Newt Gingrich was doing that then, too.
In the 70s or 80s?
Late 70s.
So North was working. My first awareness of North and FEMA had to do with his work on the Rex 84 martial law contingency plans.
Well, that was 84. But no, he was around actually in the late 70s.
And working with FEMA even then?
Well, I don't recall exactly when FEMA was created, but it was the precursor even to FEMA. Actually, it was a carryover from the old garden plot cable splicer operations in California, where
sure.
Ed Meese and so forth were working.
Absolutely, and the team that put that together down at the San Luis Obispo Specialized Training Institute then jumped to FEMA.
Right.
Go ahead. Is the funding of FEMA is actually linked to the drug traffic?
According to the suit and Bill Tyree, yes. That's not my particular area of contribution for that.
Okay.
But I have read the complaint, and it looks pretty solid there.
One of the most stunning of the allegations concerns the involvement of Albert Vincent Caron as a bagman making payments to Jack Ruby, and also his allegation that he was on a rooftop at Love Field as part of a possible plan to kill President Kennedy before the motorcade got underway.
Yeah, we've got a number of sources that will tie Albert Caron in. Now, some of this stuff is just beginning to be put down in deposition, so I don't know how far I can go, but I will say that Caron's daughter, which includes Dee Caron, who was central to the suit, but also she has a sister, her husband, Dee's husband, have all recounted specific tales over the years of Al Caron talking about his meeting with Jack Ruby on November 21st, 63. In addition, we have another retired NYPD detective who's been at this for a long time, and I can't name him for the time being. He will be a witness, or should be. Who definitely knows that Al Caron knew Frank Sturgis very well.
Mm-hmm.
And Sturgis, of course, and by any number of sources, has been placed in Dallas and connected to the assassination.
Certainly his name crops up in connection with it.
Yes.
This is an awesome lawsuit. Let me just for a second, and I don't want to linger on this point either, play devil's advocate. There might be those, and I would not be among them, but there might be those looking at the incredible scope of activities that are touched on by this lawsuit and would say that, well, this is sort of a shotgun scattershot approach and that it would therefore not be a particularly tight entity as a legal document.
Unfortunately, that's not true. Or fortunately, excuse me, that's not true. I misspoke there.
Right.
Where this all comes together, where there is a nexus, and I, you know, I've been at this now for 21 years. I've been chasing the shadow government.
And you also have a background as an LAPD narcotics detective.
Right.
Okay.
And I come from a whole family of spooks, too. These circles are very small. You find throughout the course of, just to look at CIA drug dealing, perhaps 15, 20, 25 people who turn up in every CIA covert drug operation from Italy in 43 up to the present day. You know, obviously some are old and getting phased out, but basically it's the same cadre. Well, that same cadre of people was also very closely tied to the assassinations, as I've covered in other articles about RFK and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Albert Caron was, he was huge. He was, I mean, he introduced his son to Richard Nixon, his stepson to Richard Nixon. Santos Traficante was Uncle Sonny to the families, and this is a guy who was a detective first grade at NYPD.
Mm-hmm.
He had Bill Casey's home phone number in Locust Valley, Long Island, in his phone book, and I've held that phone book in my hand.
On the same page as Paulie Castellano.
Same page as Paulie Castellano. Caron was central to everything, and he really exemplifies the closeness of the relationship between the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mafia, which was, we've been kind of led to believe over the years via Jack Anderson and so forth that, oh, they occasionally did business together. No, hand and glove like brother and sister. They are together all the time.
It goes back to the suppression of some of the communist-connected labor unions and labor movements in the immediate post-World War II period.
Absolutely. So Caron was central, and Caron turns up in this lawsuit, and if you read the story, you saw that we already have court cases ordering Massachusetts to turn over diaries, which they admit that they took illegally. Now, we have since found out, and this was the big aha in this case, that Albert Caron was the guy who retrieved Elaine Tyree's diaries at the direct orders of George Bush.
Right.
After the murder.
Mm-hmm.
And since we already have criminal judgments showing that Massachusetts admitted the diaries existed, defying the court orders to return the diaries, and since we now recently have the corroborative evidence from the Caron family, that he had the diaries up until 89,
mm-hmm.
We have a very tight case.
A couple of things. We're running low on time. There are a number of points I'd like to touch on briefly. Now, one of the defendants in the case, A. Paul Cellucci, actually he completed William Weld's term as governor of Massachusetts, correct?
Correct, he did.
William Weld himself, who was nominated by Bill Clinton to be ambassador to Mexico, is not at all unconnected to some of these events.
No, William Weld was the the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department during Iran-Contra, and he is the man who stonewalled every criminal investigation into CIA drug dealing throughout the Contra years, worked very closely with Oliver North, was very close friends with everyone in the Reagan administration, Poindexter, the whole crew. He was part and parcel of that secret team, to use Fletcher Prouty's term, that squashed the investigations into CIA drug dealing in the 80s.
And as I've said before, neither myself nor any of these stations has any evidence incriminating any of these people in any criminal activities. That's just pro forma.
Right.
Another name that we discussed and that I discussed in the first two half-hour segments that I did accessing information from the wilderness, Mike, is a fellow named Dois Jean or Chip Tatum. I was surprised to find him as a friendly defendant in the lawsuit. Tell us more about him briefly, if you would.
Well, Chip, many people have heard of the Tatum Chronicles. He was a covert operative during the period, and a lot of people have raised questions about Chip, and I've spoken with him many times, not recently. But you know, he turned up some utterly fabulous stuff about Bush and the Reagan administration and North and CIA dealing drugs, including documents, a letter from George Bush, eyeball, hands-on stuff. Yes, I was here. I saw CIA moving the drugs here. I moved the drugs here, so on and so forth. He had been public. He was slightly disgruntled. He was ordered to assassinate an American citizen in America, and he wouldn't do it. That's when he left. But he's been outspoken, and he's been fighting a battle with them. Now, he had supposedly reached a deal with the government. This was the last time I spoke to him, which was, I think, in April.
And you mentioned that in your newsletter, and we read that earlier.
But now, in this case, he is friendly to both myself and Tyree, but we have to subpoena him because we believe he needs the protection of being subpoenaed to say all the things he wants to without violating whatever deals or settlements he may have reached on his own.
Got it. By the way, in a phone-in session, when I accessed the first information about this lawsuit, a caller said he'd heard him on a right-wing Christian station, and when this caller called him up and asked him if he knew any connection between George Bush and the Nazis, Chip Tatum alleged that he had been sent down by George Bush to Argentina to assassinate some former SS men who were basically exerting a profound influence over George Bush, but wanted to exert more influence, and they did. He did that at the behest of George Bush, whatever the veracity of those particular claims. As we wind down to the tail end of the lawsuit, Mike, several of the a number of the operatives, the fellow participants of Bill Tyree and Watchtower, have met with unnatural ends, I guess one could say. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, if you go through the Cutolo affidavit, which I have available through my website and the stuff that I do, you can count no less than 27 murders, including Archbishop Romero, five Special Forces colonels, a U.S. Congressman, Larkin Smith. I mean, people are dropping like flies throughout all of this. And they were for quite a period of time from roughly the late 70s through about 91, 92 when Nick Rowe went in the Philippines. So there's people dropping dead all over the place. And, of course, if you do the actuarial count, the odds against that happening are probably pretty slim.
Uh-huh, okay. And I noticed that Bill McCoy died suddenly. Very quickly, Mike, I'm going to read the information about where to get the newsletter, because we're almost out of time. From the Wilderness can be obtained from P.O. Box 6061-350, Sherman Oaks, California, 91413. Mike Rupert's email number, mruppert@copvcia.com. Website, www.copvcia.com. Phone and fax numbers, both in the 818 area code. Phone 788-8791 and fax 981-2847. We're almost out of time, Mike. On behalf of the American people, I want to thank you and the other participants in this lawsuit. And I also want to wish that God protect you, because I think you're going to need it.
Thank you, Dave, very much, and you too.